Support for the Exchange Podcast comes from you, our sustaining members, and from New Hampshire School Administrators Association, representing school superintendents and administrators, championing the education of children in our state every day since 1941. In today's ever-changing world, public education matters, and so does its leaders. Online at nhsaa.org.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Sam Evans-Brown, host of NHPR's Outside In, sitting in for Laura Kanoi, and this is The Exchange. One trillion trees. The idea started in a place that many ideas do, as a modeling study in the academic journal Science. The original study tried to answer a simple question: how much carbon could we theoretically pull out of the atmosphere by growing as many trees as we can? But instead of being lost to the obscurity of academia, something about this idea suddenly made it stick, and it leapt into the mainstream. Republican lawmakers in Congress trying to articulate a new conservative climate policy have taken up the cause and are said to be drafting laws to encourage reforestation. And earlier this month, it was the only environmental initiative that President Donald Trump mentioned in his State of the Union address.
To protect the environment, days ago, I announced that the United States will join the 1 Trillion Trees Initiative, an ambitious effort to bring together government and private sector to plant new trees in America and all around the world.
But the original study that spawned this idea has come under fire for being impractical, infeasible, and unrealistic. And these recent Republican efforts to discuss solutions to climate change have been met with skepticism by those who see them as too little and too late. So today on The Exchange, a trillion trees. Can it be done? What would it look like? And what does this initiative tell us about the state of climate politics? We want to hear from you. Give us a call now, 1-800-892-6477. You can send us an email at exchange@nhpr.org. Or comment on Facebook. Just go to Facebook and search for NHPR Exchange. That's all one word. Right now, we've got Lisa Friedman, a New York Times reporter on the climate desk, focusing on climate and environmental policy in Washington. Lisa, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And Annie Ropeek, NHPR's energy and environment reporter. Hey, Annie.
Hi, Sam.
So I think just for starters, how important is this this idea of planting trees, afforestation, and in fighting climate change, and why? And Annie, maybe we'll start with you.
So afforestation is planting trees where there are none. Trees obviously are one way to soak up carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. This has always happened where we've had trees, but right now we have this carbon imbalance going on, and so planting more trees could help us bring that balance back into a good place. And so I was looking at Project Drawdown, which is sort of a climate solutions ranking project, and they put afforestation as number 15 on their list for results by 2030. It could reduce 18 gigatons of carbon dioxide. It would cost $29 billion to do that. And of course, planting trees has plenty of other benefits, too. It helps keep the soil intact, prevent erosion, restore habitat, and things like that.
So, Lisa, maybe you can tell us a bit about the genesis of this idea and its evolution. How did it wind up in President Trump's State of the Union address?
Yeah, well, it's a winding, complicated story. And like a lot of things in this White House, this did not go through the sort of traditional policy channels that, when you cover Washington for a long time, you learn that certain things are vetted through the policy shop before they get anywhere near the president's speech and public pronouncement. When we heard the president announce that the United States would join the Trillion Tree Initiative, first in Davos, actually, and then in his State of the Union speech, it was a complete surprise to most of his policy people who work on energy and environment issues. And it got there because Al Gore, the former vice president, had talked about this issue with Mark Benioff, the CEO of Salesforce and an environmental philanthropist himself who is very involved and on the board of the World Economic Forum. He then talked to a number of scientists, folks like Jane Goodall, scientists that he works with at his initiative that he helps fund at UC Santa Barbara, brought it to the World Economic Forum. They said, how can we get businesses, countries on board? And he took it to Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law, who really embraced this idea and, you know, took the lead on getting this into and onto the president's radar. Now, there's a few things happening at once here. This isn't just that the, you know, White House recognized, you know, an interesting idea. Republicans and the White House, for all of President Trump's, you know, sort of mocking of climate science and working against climate change within the levers of government, the White House has been looking for ways to soften his image on the environment. And Republicans in Congress separately have been looking for ways to address climate change from what they consider a conservative perspective, not regulation that Democrats want, but something else and something new. And so this all kind of converged at the same time.
So what do you think it is exactly about the idea of planting trees that makes it the one that we find at the center of this convergence? I mean, what message do you think President Trump is trying to send with this being the only initiative that he mentions in his State of the Union address?
Well, look, I mean, first and foremost, I think, you know, we should be clear that the all of the initiatives that Republicans are putting forward to address climate change have one thing in common. They do not actually involve reducing fossil fuels. You know, the Trillion Tree Initiative is one. There are others to boost funding for capturing carbon and storing it. There's others for, you know, for nuclear energy. So that's the first thing I'd say. You know, when President Trump talks about this initiative, the two times he has, we haven't heard the words climate change, but it is undeniably a climate change effort. So I think that for the White House, this is attractive, perhaps because it can be billed as an environmental good without having to get into the climate discussion. And look, who doesn't like trees?
Indeed, you quote Mark Benioff as saying, you know, nobody is anti-tree or something along those
exactly.
lines.
Exactly.
So this is a global initiative, right? And so maybe you could outline, you know, what the actual initiative itself that the United States says it's signing on to is, and who's behind it.
Well, there are not too many details yet, but right now this is an initiative spawned out of the World Economic Forum. You know, a number of other countries, Colombia and others have signed on, businesses have signed on. But what does that mean to join? I mean, what does it mean when President Trump says the United States will join? That is still really unclear. Is there money that the United States is going to put forward? It wasn't in the budget. If some is coming, you know, that's still really unclear. I have heard that that there will be a dollar figure put to this from some quarters of the administration. Others I've heard are really resisting that. I have heard that, you know, that the White House is actively looking for a numerical target that they can get behind for both planting trees domestically and encouraging the planting of trees in other countries, but all of that is just very hazy right now, and we're still waiting for answers.
Remember, listeners, we want to hear from you too. What do you think of this idea that the U.S. is signing on to this massive new effort to reforest the globe? Is this progress to hear Donald Trump has signed on to a climate initiative? Give us a call now, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email at exchange@nhpr.org. Or you can comment on Facebook. We're already getting comments through Facebook. Len says, without significant carbon reductions, this is useless. So Annie, we talked a bit about how nobody's anti-tree, right? So this is a fairly palatable climate solution as they go. You've done some reporting here locally on the biomass issue in New Hampshire. Tell us a bit about the political dynamics when it comes to Republicans and trees.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So New Hampshire is the second most forested state in the country. So we're the most concentrated number of trees after Maine, which is really something when you think about how small of a state this is. And Maine's a really big state. And so our forest products industry, as it's known up here, is super important to the economy. It's some number of billions of dollars worth of an industry, still not as big as tourism and other industries here. But, you know, it has a lot of cultural value. It's our oldest industry. We get a little bit of our power from it, though, you know, increasingly less. Those biomass plants, as you mentioned, the wood burning power plants, haven't really been able to prove themselves economical without some state help, which has become a huge political issue in New Hampshire in the past few years. And really, basically, we've seen most of those plants go idle after state subsidies kind of were voted down on narrow margins in the last legislative session. There's a couple of bigger biomass plants that have stayed alive. So this, you know, all gets into sort of the types of trees that we have in our forest. All of our current forests were sort of replanted after we were agricultural for a while in like the olden days. There are different kinds of forests. The trees have different uses, different carbon values and sort of ecological values. And some in the industry, including many Republicans, will argue that you need to be able to harvest some of those trees in order to actually keep those forests healthy. So you have to sort of cull the dead or dying or sick trees and make room for the trees to get more sunlight, that kind of thing. Forest management is a big thing up here. And I mean, I think when you think about a trillion trees, the idea of that is that it would basically max out the available area on the globe to plant trees. So we're not talking about the very sort of granular management practices that we have in a place like New Hampshire, where forestry is really an agricultural practice. This is more, you know, wildlands that we're talking about. So it's a different kind of thing. And I think when we got down to the level of people asking, okay, what are we going to do with all of those trees? It becomes sort of a circular argument. But, you know, I think you could expect to probably hear that thread picked up in the Northeast. Certainly, it's definitely a political issue.
Lisa, the original study that this idea was based on made some fairly extreme claims, as Annie alluded to here. To what extent do you think that the excitement around this idea comes from the idea that it is sort of a silver bullet stemming from the numbers that came out of that first study?
You know, I'm pausing because, you know, when I did this story on how the Trillion Tree Initiative sort of came into the president's speech, I spoke with Tom Crowther, the one of the authors of the original study, and he he said, you know, I didn't even know what silver bullet meant. I'm sure I didn't say it, but somehow it's been used in the context of this. If you think of it as kind of an anachronistic term, and he's a young guy, but I think that the idea that this is a silver bullet is something that the authors themselves are working maybe belatedly. You know, I think early on in their excitement, you know, they were talking about the great potential of this, but, you know, from what I've seen, are now working very hard to walk back and make sure that people understand that, you know, this is a part of a solution. It is not the solution. That yes, you know, if you, you know, worldwide reforestation of a trillion trees could reduce a tremendous amount of, you know, 25% of atmospheric carbon, but right? I mean, it takes 100 years for right. For the trees to grow to maturity. What happens to the carbon that we are still putting into the atmosphere during that time? I think there is a lot of excitement about it because it is an attractive effort that does not involve changing the economies of parts of the country and parts of the world that still depend on the production of fossil fuels. But, you know, like I said, I mean, even the people who are, you know, who have done this research have adamantly said that, you know, job one is reducing fossil fuel emissions.
My favorite detail from your story was that when you talked to Mr. Crowther, he was in an RV somewhere very remote trying to hide from all the press that had come from his study.
Morocco.
Yeah, in Morocco, right. Annie, you had a thought?
Yeah, just on one other statistic I saw that kind of brings home this idea that we have to sort of reduce emissions in order to be able to use trees as a viable solution and max that out, that if we stay on our current emissions path, we'll lose a quarter of the available area for those trillion trees by 2050. And so it's, you almost have to start the process in order to use this solution and to help it be a part of the solution. Like the Facebook commenter said, you know, without other emissions reductions, this really is not going to be effective.
Randy from Center Harbor is on the line. We'd like to hear from you as well. But Randy, you're on the exchange. What do you have to say?
Well, a couple of things. One of the things that I think is being neglected as a result of spending 12 plus years in Colorado working to develop a program and product lines that utilize the lodgepole ponderosa pine that is basically being wiped out across the West. Most people aren't aware that 60 to 90% of all pine forest in the West, in British Columbia, all Western states spanning over 160 million acres, have largely died off during this beetle kill epidemic that took place in an unprecedented format. They've managed to get up into British Columbia, which they had never done before because it was too cold, and that's their only quote-unquote natural predator. They've jumped the continental divide. They're heading towards the East Coast, of course, across the boreal forest. We're talking billions and billions and billions of trees. And those trees have all stored carbon. And the only outcome that can result is as they die and burn and decay, that they are going to release all that carbon that they have been storing. So there's an offset that we need to be taking a look at. And do we need to replant? Yes, we are going to need to replant because the entire environment and habitat of the West is changing in a very short period of time as a result of just a degree or two of temperature change. The spruce beetle epidemic is kicking in now, and that's taking place all across the West, wiping out our spruce trees. And they actually have years in the forest system that we are going to lose most of our spruce.
So, Annie, Randy brings up an important point here, which is that reforestation, while a good idea, there are troubles with forests. They're a living thing and can be attacked by insects, for instance. You've done some reporting on forest health here in New England. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, it gets back to this idea that you can't just plant the trees and kind of expect that that's a one and done solution, that it requires management, and that there are also, as Randy brings up, you know, there are other climate change driven problems that face those trees, invasive species and new kinds of pests and blight that can destroy large swaths of forests, as Randy mentions, are climate change driven. You know, as new areas warm, those invasive species can infringe on new areas that they didn't used to be able to survive, where trees aren't designed to be able to deal with them because they don't expect to have them there based on our historic climate. And so, again, it just gets back to this idea that there really are other solutions that need to take place and probably management efforts that need to take place. I mean, here in New England, you know, we have the emerald ash borer. In New Hampshire, the ash trees are not a huge part of our forest products industry. They're sort of, it's like low volume, high value. And so they are actively trying to eradicate those emerald ash borer with, engineered wasps and crazy things like that. And it takes efforts like that. And you know, we're going to see those spread. And so we're going to be kind of fighting on multiple fronts in that way.
We've got Lori from Deerfield on the line. Lori, your thoughts about this trillion trees idea?
Yeah, good morning. I'm wondering if this is not in the budget, how is it going to be paid for? And is this a good use of $10 billion, given that we really need to reduce carbon emissions to really make any impact whatsoever?
Lisa, maybe we'll throw that question to you. This obviously is very expensive. How does it stack up compared to other ways of mitigating climate change?
Sure. I mean, well, let me take the first question first. I mean, if this isn't in the budget, how is it going to be paid for is a great one. Republicans, there's a couple of different initiatives, to be clear. What the Republicans in the House are discussing, it may not necessarily be what the White House winds up emerging with. But what is being discussed right now on the Hill are essentially a combination of tax credits for businesses to, you know, so private industry would do the actual reforestation. When I spoke with my sources at the White House about the issue of this not being in the budget for the president's, you know, goal, whatever that winds up being, the response was on the order of, well, we've seen how the budget goes. Just because something isn't in the budget when we introduce the budget does not mean that it won't get in the budget by the time Congress right. passes the budget. So, you know, then becomes the question of, is this the right thing to spend the money on? And really, you know, I mean, that's, you know, I don't think that's something for me to answer necessarily. I just think that there is a, I think Congress is really, but I will say Congress is really struggling with how to approach, I think Democrats are struggling with how to approach this new interest among Republicans on climate change. And they're questioning both how seriously to take it and whether to accept, a good and insufficient proposal when there is, you know, another reality of, look, there is so much more to do and maybe more pressing things or things that are more deserving of federal dollars.
All right.
You know, I think you're saying that play out on the Hill right now.
Coming up, we will shift from politics to practice. When more than half of forest land in the United States is privately owned, how do you ensure that more trees are planted and don't get cut down? We do want to hear from you. Call 1-800-892-6477. You can also email us. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Sam Evans Brown. We'll be right back. I'm Sam Evans Brown, and this is The Exchange. Today, we're talking about the idea of planting a trillion trees. Reforestation has become a centerpiece of a burgeoning Republican response to climate change, and we're talking about the politics and practicality of planting trees. Joining me today are Lisa Friedman, a New York Times reporter on the climate desk, focusing on climate and environmental policy in Washington, and Annie Ropeek, NHPR's energy and environment reporter. And listeners, this is your chance to weigh in. The phone number is 1-800-892-6477, or you can email us exchange@nhpr.org. Lisa, we've touched on this a little bit, but I'd like to dive into the question a little more. The broader political context here is that in the last decade or so, Republicans have sort of ceded the field when it comes to proposing solutions to climate change. So how does reforestation fit into the GOP's rediscovery of the climate issue?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, we've seen over the past year, Republicans really working to come to terms with, you know, 30 plus years of climate denial, and, you know, and questioning the science. And now they are looking at, they have a number of things happening. On the one hand, you have Democrats taking over the House and holding climate hearings every week. You have the Green New Deal, which has put an enormous amount of attention on climate change. And while Republicans, you know, by and large have criticized this as a deeply radical initiative that would decimate the economy of communities, the second question they've been getting is, well, what's your idea then? What's your plan? If you don't like this, what do you want to do about climate change? And there's been some real hard thought happening on this score within the Republican Party. They're also looking at polls that, you know, increasingly show that young people and young Republicans believe that climate change is happening, that it is largely driven by man-made emissions, and they want to see a government solution. Again, you know, very different party, very different solutions. This is not a party that wants to see regulation. This is not a party that wants to see a dramatic reduction in the industries that power many of their constituencies, and so they've been on a search for things that they can that they can really support. And it's come down to a few things, like trees, like innovation, like CCS and nuclear. You know, one of the more interesting proposals out there right now is one that does not involve trees, and it isn't, you know, again, it's one that's not fully written yet, but Congressman McKinley, a Republican from West Virginia, obviously coal state, and Congressman Schrader from Pacific Northwest are working on bipartisan legislation, and their idea is to fund, again, the figure is not clear, but they say that, you know, it would be a worth it amount of billions of dollars, presumably, to fund carbon capture and other energy innovation, and give industry an assurance that there would be no carbon emissions regulations for a decade. That would then regulations would then kick in a decade later, whether or not, you know, industry is ready. There are real efforts afoot to try to find ways to work together. And Trillion Trees is one of them. When I spoke to Carlos Curbelo, he's a former Florida congressman from a Republican from Florida who, really was out front for his party. He was one of the very, very few advocating for a carbon tax. His take on this I thought was very interesting. He said, you know, look, it's not, of course, it's not enough, but before you didn't even have Republicans at the table because they were denying the science. You know, maybe this is not enough, but you can't have a negotiation until someone's at the table. So this is what Republicans have brought to the table. And, you know, and maybe this is the start of discussions on how to move forward. Remains to be seen.
Linda has sent us an email. She says, let's embrace tree planting as a good thing instead of being snarky about it. It's not an either or. Of course, it's a political fig leaf, but it has so, so many benefits. And it does, and it doesn't stop efforts to reduce fossil fuels and other important initiatives to stop poisoning our environment. Pamela in Marlborough writes, planting trees is a very good idea. The green belt across Africa is an example. Restoring grasslands also helps sequester carbon. People in many countries are on board with this idea.
And wetlands, I would add.
And wetlands. Well, and Annie, along those lines, to what extent do we need negative emissions as well as reducing emissions if we are going to preserve the climate below the temperature goals that we set for ourselves?
I think it would certainly help. I mean, we can begin to see emissions drop off through an energy transition, you know, as rapidly as possible, and we'll still have large amounts of carbon in the atmosphere. Those, you know, impacts are thought to already be somewhat baked in to a certain extent because of how much carbon is in the atmosphere. And is not coming out of the atmosphere. So trees are one way to soak up that carbon. Healthy soils, wetlands, grasslands, peatlands are all others. Basically, just healthy natural environments, you know, that's how the carbon cycle is supposed to work. And right now we, like I said before, we have this imbalance of sort of the built environment not being able to soak up that carbon, and we're burning more than we're taking out, basically. And so, you know, there's sort of two kinds of like these negative emissions strategies that Democratic presidential candidates, for example, are talking about. A lot of them will frame negative emissions just in terms of these natural solutions. So soil health, sequestration through agricultural practices, conservation, tree planting, and that kind of things. But some of them go farther, and we'll actually talk about what Lisa mentioned earlier, which is carbon capture and sequestration, or direct air capture. So you're actually building machines that will suck the carbon dioxide out of the air and squirrel it away. You can either use it as a fuel, maybe. I mean, there's lots of different potential applications, or you can just inject it into the earth, essentially, and keep it down there where it came from. This is a somewhat unproven technology. It's in its sort of early stages. The costs are very unknown at this point, and sort of the long-term impacts. But I mean, like with anything, there are going to be trade-offs for whatever we do. And so I think that, like these commenters are saying, you know, in all of the above strategy, you know, every little bit will help. And I think the question is, do some solutions kind of distract in the political sense from other potential solutions, or can you really just do everything at once and not have to pick and choose. And I mean, I think that really is the $1 trillion question here.
And Lisa, I know you've got to hit the road. You've got a hearing to make it to, but any final thoughts on that question of negative emissions before you do?
Well, I'll just take up the political question a minute. And I think that you know, as you're saying, I mean, this is becoming a question of, do you wait until you have a perfect all-encompassing solution, or can you take up pieces like the caller said that might not be perfect, but you know, certainly will make a difference. You know, I think that if you know, if Democrats were to take this up, I think it would be a pretty interesting thing to watch. It's not clear that that's going to happen.
All right. Thank you for being with us. Lisa Friedman is a reporter with the New York Times Climate Desk.
Thank you.
Sarah from Manchester is on the line. Sarah, what are your thoughts about this reforestation initiative?
I hate to be the snarky voice of youth, but I think that what some people might see as snark is actually anger and frustration and a feeling like someone's trying to pull one over on us. This sounds like an idea that someone is trying to trick a group of kindergartners with. It's so sad and so defeatist that we can't trust our institutions to actually do the hard work of getting us off of fossil fuels. So instead, we're just going to plant a bunch of trees and that's going to like totally take care of it. So, if someone feels like people are being snarky about this, it's because it sounds absurd. And people older than the coming generations have had a lifetime of time to deal with this and haven't done it yet.
So, Annie, maybe we could address the frustration here a bit by talking a little more closely about what the Democrats are proposing and how they have approached the question of negative emissions, as well as the flip side of the coin, reducing emissions.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really glad that sort of generational question came up here, because I think that, you know, like, we're doing a lot of talk and not very much acting here. And for young people, you know, you and I included, that is frustrating to see that, you know, this can feel like a Band-Aid solution. And especially if it feels like politically it's going to be, you know, if we're going to spend all our political capital on the tree planting and not do anything else, you know, maybe that's not enough. And that's terrifying. And so so it has been really interesting to see how the Democratic presidential candidates frame this just as sort of a lens on, you know, what public policy could look like under a Democratic administration, or even on, you know, in divided government, on how they would approach this issue, trying to work across the aisle. And so they do include a lot of public lands and waters and tree and agriculture goals in their plans. A lot of them have signed on to this idea that I think originally came from sort of a scientific coalition to conserve 30% of public lands and waters across the world. To conserve 30% of the land and water on the globe by 2030. And in the U.S., we would do this through public land and water conservation. Several candidates will mention actually building renewables on public lands as a sort of idea of how to use public lands as part of the solution. A lot of them talk about, like I said earlier, soil conservation, permanently funding the Land and Water Conservation Fund, which has funded a lot of conservation projects, including here in New Hampshire. And our Republican governor, Chris Sununu, recently told Congress he'd like to see them do that permanent funding. So there are, I think we see a lot of bipartisan solutions in that column specifically. It's when you get to the bigger, more quote-unquote radical ideas that it starts to become a little less clear. If there's bipartisan support, a little bit less clear how feasible it is. The price tags start to escalate. The timelines start to get a little bit more just hard to imagine, I think. I mean, these are big solutions to an incredibly big problem. And things like, you know, making all new vehicles zero emissions by after 2028, or all new buildings zero carbon after 2030. It can feel hard to know how we'll get there, but those are in their platforms, too.
Now, as we mentioned earlier, the majority of forested land in the United States is privately held. So how do we convince timberland owners that they should not only plant trees, but also leave them standing, not cut them down? So far, the answer to that question has been carbon offsets, paying large landowners not to cut down trees using various market-based credit trading systems. Joining us now over the phone to discuss carbon markets is David Publicover, senior staff scientist at the Appalachian Mountain Club. David, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for inviting me.
So, Dave, let's start with an easy one. A lot of folks might look around New Hampshire and say, hey, we already have one of the most forested states in the country. How many more trees can we actually grow in a place like New Hampshire?
Well, in New Hampshire and in the eastern United States in general, the opportunities are pretty limited. Any piece of ground that's capable of supporting forest is already growing trees. We don't need to plant them unless we are preventing that from happening because we're using the land for other things like agriculture and development. So the opportunities to increase forest land in New Hampshire are really limited unless you want to start giving up our limited amount of agricultural land.
Dave, the AMC has tried to bid some of its forest land into carbon markets to craft projects to sell as carbon offsets. So explain to us just the basics here. What is a carbon offset and how do they work?
Well, simply put, a carbon offset is an action taken by one party to balance or offset the emissions of another party. If you imagine, if you're Walmart and you're trying to reduce your corporate carbon emissions, you do the easy stuff, you know, efficient lighting, more efficient vehicles. But at some point, it becomes more economically feasible to pay someone else to reduce their emissions on your behalf and to pay them to do that. And that's what a carbon offset is, one party taking a carbon-friendly action to balance the emissions of another party.
And when we look at the forest lands that you all own, what does that look like? I mean, how is that substantively different from what you would be doing otherwise with your land?
Well, for a forest project, you're compared against a baseline of a regional average. So if you were doing a better job of sequestering carbon than your neighbors, you get credit for that additional carbon storage above and beyond the regional average. And that's what we've done in two projects on our lands. We've taken two areas that have been set aside as ecological reserves and will continue to sequester carbon for many decades. And we can get credits for that that accumulation of carbon in our forest, and then those credits can be sold to other parties looking to offset their emissions.
Dave, I feel like I've lost count of the number of articles that I've read that call the landscape of carbon offsets a wild west. So how are they regulated? What is the landscape of carbon offsets, and can we trust them?
I think in the United States, the carbon offset programs are quite rigorous and quite well developed. The protocols for which there are basically three major nonprofit organizations that track carbon offsets and have developed protocols. The methodologies for quantifying the carbon offsets are very well developed and consistent. The verification process, you know, every project requires a third-party verification, is quite well established and rigorous. So I think for United States projects, people can have pretty good assurance that they're credible. In the developing countries, you know, some of the larger tropical forest projects that have been being developed under the Kyoto Protocol and its subsequent programs, those standards are still being developed. So those projects have more issues in terms of credibility.
Even here in the United States, though, a lot of these credits are sold on the assumption that the trees will be there standing for at least 100 years. Given the fact that the climate is shifting quite rapidly, can we be sure that some of the baseline assumptions that these protocols make are still valid given the shifting reality on the ground, even if no one cuts them down? I mean, can we be sure that they will still be there given climate change?
Well, climate change, you know, throws a monkey wrench into everything. So, you know, the assurances that, you know, if it's going to stay forest, you have to re-inventory, you have to be re-verified over this 100-year period. So that provides the assurance that they will be there. A significant portion of our credits have to go into what's called a buffer pool. It's sort of an insurance And if something happens, a natural event that wipes out large parts of our carbon stocking, that is, credits are retired from that buffer pool. So that's, you know, sort of offsetting that natural event. But, you know, in areas where climate change threatens to, you know, eliminate forests entirely, that's an open question as to how these carbon offset markets will deal with that, with projects that, you know, essentially where the forests go away. And I don't know if people are clear on how that'll be dealt with.
We are going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we will talk about where tree planting efforts have hit snags in the past. Remember, we do want to hear from you. Call now 1-800-892-6477 or email us at exchange@nhpr.org. This is The Exchange. I'm Sam Evans Brown.
From the seacoast to the Upper Valley, Monadnock to the Great North Woods, NHPR covers the stories that impact your community to help you stay connected to what's happening in every corner of the state. I'm Annie Ropeek, a reporter here at NHPR, and when you give $10 a month as a sustainer, you'll help support a vital resource that is statewide, regional, and deeply New Hampshire. Give today at nhpr.org.
I'm Sam Evans Brown, and today on The Exchange, we are talking about the idea of massively ramping up reforestation with the 1 Trillion Trees Initiative. Tomorrow on The Exchange, we take a look at New Hampshire news with the New Hampshire News Roundup, so be there for that. But right now, joining me to talk about reforestation and its potential solution as to climate change is Annie Ropeek, NHPR's energy and environment reporter, and also Cynthia in Dover. Cynthia, your thoughts about this talk of reforestation?
Well, I want to remind the readers, the prominent Republican George Bush said that fossil fuels are an addiction. And so we can't let reforestation, as noble and beautiful as it is, distract us from the idea that we have to get off this addiction to fossil fuels. And furthermore, I'd like to see some science done before we give any tax credits to somebody who is wealthy enough to plant trees for tax credit purposes. Before we spend those dollars or give away those dollars, we need to see if those dollars would be better spent letting average Americans weatherize and make their houses more energy efficient. This gives us local jobs and puts money back in average Americans' pockets. So reforestation is great, but it really has to be examined with a critical eye.
I'm hearing a lot of skepticism about this idea of reforestation. Charles on Facebook says it will take too long before the trees get big enough to really help. Any thoughts about all of this skepticism?
Yeah, it's really interesting to hear. I mean, I think people, you know, maybe if we were having this conversation 5 or 10 years ago, it would be different. But I think you see this from a lot of politicians as well, that, you know, we may be at a stage of climate change where these sort of solutions are just not big enough, and it almost can feel not worth it to spend time on the more piecemeal solutions when the problem is at such a critical point and such, you know, a moment where the biggest possible action is needed, where it's sort of past time to do it in a piecemeal way. We see that even for the idea of a price on carbon, that Bernie Sanders backed off of supporting that and said it's too little too late. And I think what I'm hearing from listeners is a sense that that may be true of planting trees as well.
Joining us now via Skype is Sarah Sachs, an environmental journalist whose byline has appeared in Wired, Vice, and Pacific Standard, among others. Sarah has written about reforestation in the developing world and challenges it faces there. Sarah, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Sarah, as I just mentioned, a lot of talk about reforestation has focused on the developing world and not reforestation here in the United States, for instance. Why is that?
I suppose the kind of quickest answer is because in many ways there's a hierarchy in terms of what forests are important for carbon sequestration. And obviously all trees are important, but, you know, specifically intact natural rainforests in the kind of global south generally sequester, you know, significantly more carbon than trees in the north do.
So to what extent can we be sure that a carbon credit sold to support reforestation in you know, in the developing world, but really in any other country, will work?
I mean, I think you can. I mean, this is the, you know, the big debate kind of going on right now. How can you and how sure can you be? And the answer is, you know, we can't really be sure right now. You know, the science just isn't quite there in many cases to actually have a kind of standardized way of, you know, measuring the carbon. I think that's where so many of the problems are coming from. You know, when people critique all of the different kinds of carbon markets that are coming up in the world, or anything from, you know, Red Plus or forest bonds, is that, you know, it's really hard. Forests are so different. They're so diverse. There's so many factors affecting them. It's really hard to actually establish what the precise measurement is.
So last year, Lisa Song with ProPublica published this remarkable investigation showing that at least in some cases, specifically in Cambodia, where they did analysis of satellite imagery, forests that had been sold and carbon projects have in fact disappeared even after the carbon offsets had been sold. And I think that that report, as well as a lot of academic work that has been done, has seemed to really been fueling a lot of the skepticism behind reforestation as a climate solution. Is that your perception as well?
Yeah, I'm 100%. I mean, I think, you know, the same with Vietnam. There was a great study out last year that showed, depending on how you defined a forest, Vietnam had either lost a bunch of forest or grown back a bunch of forest. And that really fits into their ability to, you know, get credits from, you know, the reducing emissions from forest degradation and deforestation, which is the main, you know, UN way to give developing countries money for reforesting again, or for keeping carbon in forests. And, you know, I think what a lot of people forget is that forests in the whole climate change debate are really kind of a latecomer. Like climate change, IPCC, all of these different protocols that we have created were created mainly to measure energy and to measure emissions from oil and gas and coal, and land use changes were brought on later on as kind of a political way to make a lot of countries look better. And so the science wasn't really there and is only now being developed as trees and forests and land use get this kind of second wave of enthusiasm around them. And so we are at a really interesting point where, you know, now with satellites, we're able to measure carbon a lot better, and there's a lot of really exciting stuff coming out in that field this year. But I would say we're not, you know, especially in the developing country where we don't have a lot of these protocols, we're not really there yet to be able to determine a lot of, you know, the actual carbon in the forests.
We're going to take
especially not for a market.
Okay, sorry about that. We're going to take a call now from Penty in Pembroke. Penty, your thoughts about reforestation as a climate solution?
Well, I certainly support the idea of reforestation where we can do it. But the question is, if we're trying to use that for carbon storage, natural cycles are the bugs will eat it and the forest fire will burn it. And the question then is, how do we best use the land itself? Are we growing food? Are we growing fiber? Are we growing energy? And my sense would be that we really should be looking at the rate of carbon capture. Once you've got a 100-year-old forest, it's not capturing much anymore. You know, the bank's full.
Sarah, this is something we hear a lot, that once a forest fully matures, it no longer sequesters carbon. Does that match up with your understanding of the science?
Again, it depends a little bit on the type of forest, but generally not. So most studies would agree that, and, you know, again, intact rainforests, especially in places like Brazil and the Amazon, the big kind of three rainforests in the world, do sequester the most carbon. And that kind of also ties back to a lot of what has been discussed here. You know, what is the best way for the United States to really support this this effort to reforest? And, you know, maybe part of the way that that could actually be done is by considering the actions and the commodities that as Americans we consume that are actually causing deforestation, because in many ways it's both about reforestation, but reforestation itself is kind of pointless without actually also maintaining the existing, you know, giant carbon stocks that we have in the form of tropical rainforests.
Any you have a thought?
Yeah, I just heard from a forestry professor over at UNH, John Gunn, who I've talked to a lot about this issue the idea that we also do need to manage the forest that we have, and so that if you harvest less often and you sort of allow trees to grow healthier and sort of mature in a healthier way for longer, that they can store more carbon. So, I mean, it's not a black and white issue. It's not like it, you know, fills up and turns off, but it is a question of again, not just planting the trees and letting them go, but of making sure that the entire ecosystem is healthy, that the soil is healthy, the air is healthy, and that, you know, if we are using these forests, that we're doing so in a responsible way that takes into account the carbon benefits that the forest provides, and also that, you know, we can use the wood from those forests to have additional carbon benefits. So instead of burning it and completely breaking it down so it re-releases its carbon, there are many things you can do with that wood that will cause it to continue to hold its carbon even if it's broken down somewhat. So you can use it to build buildings. This idea of mass timber, where buildings can be carbon sinks, even if you break down trees into some of their component parts. I saw some really insane research at UMaine a little while ago where you can make a sort of a plastic kind of substance out of trees, like a sort of like an acrylic kind of material that it continues to sequester its carbon because it's just sort of like mushed up tree pulp. It's not actually burned. And so these are a lot of choices that forest managers have to make after those trees are in the ground.
So, Annie, we've heard a bit about the importance of markets in determining what actual type of forest we wind up with. Maybe you could tell me a bit more about that. If we look here locally, for instance, how important are markets in dictating what type of forestry gets done, and what happens if forest owners don't have another source of revenue?
Yeah, I mean, going back to the biomass power question that we addressed earlier, forest managers in New Hampshire and northern New England say that they need different kinds of markets for different kinds of trees in order to be able to afford to sustainably manage those trees and not to clear cut them. And so, you know, they need something to do with the low value trees that can't be used to make lumber. They need obviously good markets for that lumber and new things to do with, you know, trees that didn't grow perfectly straight. So you can't make a nice long board out of them, but maybe you can make something that's a kind of a different shape, or you need to be able to break down the tops and the limbs and do more than just wood chip burning, but again, you know, making new kinds of pulp and paper and all kinds of products. And like I said, those have different kinds of carbon benefits. And so those really are based on market signals. That's at least what we hear from forestry folks, that based on where they have to sell those different forest products, they will manage their forests in different ways because it is their business and they have invested long term in growing these forests. You know, it's not a sort of quick return kind of business. And so, you know, a lot of them are diversifying as much as they can, trying to offer more recreation on their land, maybe building cabins. But their ultimate goal is to avoid just having to, we often hear the idea of, you know, cut it down and sell it for housing, which we don't necessarily see a lot of, but it's certainly a threat. And you know, that's why development and agriculture, like pasture land agriculture, is a big driver of deforestation worldwide.
Mike in Lee sent us an email. He writes, as climate change gets worse, everyone, conservatives as well as liberals, are starting to get more serious about solutions. Whatever is done, it needs to be acceptable to both parties, not just for the next election, but for the rest of the century. There's really only one solution that's both politically feasible and effective: put a fee on carbon and give all the proceeds back to people. So this is heading off down a tangent, I think. But I guess, Sarah, the first question I have for you is, what do you make of this argument that the real attractiveness of reforestation is that it's politically feasible?
I think from the kind of research that I've done, you know, a lot of my research has been based in tropical countries around tropical rainforests, is that there are really strong kind of lobbying bodies, both in the UN as well as in kind of developing countries, that really do see forests as the as a kind of political clout that they have. And so I think it's impossible not to think about forests in terms of how they fit into the political system. And, you know, even a lot of the discussions that have been here around biomass and bioenergy, you know, they don't exist in a vacuum. They exist because Europe has a huge demand as well, and other countries are, you know, kind of jumping on this bandwagon. And so this, you know, political, economic part of forests is also really important to take into account. And so I think it's, you know, more likely than not that forests will obviously be political as well as being, you know, their physical structures.
So we've heard a lot of skepticism about this idea this hour, but I think, Sarah, broadly and generally, is reforestation a good climate change solution? And if so, how good?
I mean, not as good as just, you know, getting ourselves off of oil and gas and coal. I think that's the bottom line that I, you know, really try to hone home is, you know, what will solve climate change is reducing our emissions. It's pretty much that simple. At the same time, overall, there's a lot of benefits as well to reforestation. And as long as it's done with the consideration of, you know, other people and communities and kind of within the larger ecosystem, it's never really, or it not is often not a bad idea. Sometimes it is, but it depends, I suppose, is the worst, but also the truest answer to that.
Just got a couple seconds left, but Annie, any final thoughts?
I think the way this story plays out here will really be about preservation versus conservation. It's about, you know, how do we prevent trees from being cut down for development, but then what do we do with them after they're planted, and what are the ongoing carbon benefits of that as we embark on our renewable energy transition as well.
That's all the time that we have for today. Thank you both for being here. Sarah Sachs is an environmental journalist who has written about global deforestation. Thank you, Sarah.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Annie Ropeek is NHPR's energy and environment reporter. Thank you, Annie.
Anytime, Sam.
Remember, this conversation continues online on Facebook and at nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Michael Brindley is our program manager. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Sam Evans-Brown. Thanks so much for listening.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.